himself, Ellison would visit Dungee in his office among the jazz clubs of Second Street. Ellison's father had died when Ralph was only two. A large block of ice he was delivering slipped and gored him in the stomach, and he was buried in the black section of Fairlawn Cemetery, not far from the graves of William Couch and his boomers, not far from Red Kelly and Officer Burnett. Shortly after the infamous lynching, in the spring of 1921, Ellison's mother decided that there was no future for her sons in Oklahoma City. The place was too brutal. She couldn't take them to the zoo or to a decent public park. There was not even a proper library for Ralph, an eager reader who had to make do with the discarded books and magazines his mother managed to scrounge from the houses uptown where she worked as a maid. So she quit her job, sold all the family's furniture, and set off with her boys for Gary, Indiana, where her brother worked in a steel mill. On their way north, the Ellisons stopped to visit a cousin in Tulsa. He lived in a neighborhood called Greenwood, and his OKC visitors would have been impressed by a zone of black life so different from Deep Deuce. Solid brick homes and shops, lawyers and doctors, wealth from the city's endless oil booms. Ellison's cousin had luxurious furniture and a baby grand piano. Tulsa was still brutally segregated, but at least its black residents had managed to make something grand in their patch. Gary, by contrast, turned out to be horrible. The steel industry crashed just after the family arrived, and Ellison's mother couldn't find work. They were reduced to eating actual garbage. Before long, they gave up and decided to head back south. Although Oklahoma City was amazingly, maddeningly flawed, it was still home. On their return trip, the Ellisons passed once more through Tulsa. This time, Greenwood was gone. During the family's brief stay in Indiana, a race riot had raged through their cousin's formerly quiet neighborhood. It had been set off by a mysterious incident in an elevator downtown, an alleged assault on a white girl's innocence, and in response, a lynch mob had gathered at the jail, and a counter mob had gathered to hold them off, and in the chaos, somebody fired a shot. The apocalypse ensued. For 2 days, white mobs went to war on Greenwood, burning everything the Ellisons had admired, its churches, shops, hospitals, and houses. Residents trying to escape were mowed down with machine guns. There were eyewitness reports of airplanes circling and dropping incendiary bombs onto the roofs of buildings, burning them from the top down. In the end, 35 city blocks were reduced to smoking rubble. 10,000 residents were left homeless. Hundreds of people slept in tents in the wreckage. No one could even say for sure how many people had been killed. When the Ellisons passed through in the aftermath, the whole ruined neighborhood smelled like death. Meanwhile, back in Oklahoma City, the KKK was ascendant. By 1923, the organization had grown so powerful that the governor, Jack Walton, declared literal war against it, imposing martial law and mounting machine guns on the roof of the county courthouse. Stanley Draper disapproved of the conflict, worrying that such visible strife would reflect poorly on OKC's growing national reputation as a business destination. The governor was impeached. A few months later, ostensibly in celebration of George Washington's birthday, the KKK took over downtown. Nearly 5,000 Klansmen marched with torches, American flags, and burning crosses. Brass bands played, and an airplane swooped festively overhead. Klanswomen rode along the parade route in 100 cars. Although it was a cold February day, more than 30,000 citizens came out to watch the parade circle the segregated downtown. It looped past the 9-story Colcord, a giant in the skyline that Ellison's father had helped build. The Oklahoman covered the parade with a lighthearted front-page story, crowd knocked cold by Ku Klux, as well as multiple playful articles describing the festivities. The faces of youth, fresh with the animation and excitement of the event, appeared beside the faces of age, lined with the cares of many events, stern and steady in their rigid turning toward the cross at the head of the column. Haze of mist and smoke could not hide an almost hysterical woman who, after watching the passing of the first fiery cross, rushed to the line of marchers, and seizing the nearest Klansman, kissed him repeatedly, crying, "Thank God." Not long after this parade, Ralph Ellison turned 10. O.A. Cargill, the county attorney who had presided over the infamous lynching 3 years before, was elected mayor. The Ellisons settled back into life in Deep Deuce. As a teenager, Ralph took up the trumpet, and the noise of him practicing out of his open window became part of the soundtrack of the community. Every morning he played reveille. The quick, peppy notes of the military camp song hopped and echoed between the buildings, waking the neighborhood up. Every evening he played taps, a mournful end to the community's day. In 1930, when Ralph Ellison was 16, Oklahoma City released its first comprehensive plan. It was explicit about black citizens' social position. Oklahoma City is primarily a city of native-born white Americans. This points to the necessity of developing a city to meet the high standards of American living and working conditions. As in most of the cities of the central and southern states, the principal racial problem centers about the Negroes. They are a necessary and useful element in the population, and proper provision should be made for their living facilities. While it is an advantage of each race that living areas be segregated, the white race should be much interested in the welfare of the Negroes because of the close contact resulting from the employment of the Negroes as servants in various capacities. Roscoe Dungee would have read this, of course, with level-headed rage. In the Black Dispatch, he railed against the Klan and called the state's new governor, Alfalfa Bill Murray, a demagogue. As OKC continued to expand under the organizing influence of Stanley Draper, as housing developments spread north along freshly poured highways, a white group called the East Side Civic League mobilized to keep black homeowners in their place. Dungee fought them in his traditional style, pushing the black frontier methodically forward, block by stubborn block, sending homeowners now all the way up to 8th Street, bailing them out when they were jailed. Alfalfa Bill Murray, outraged, issued an executive order declaring martial law in the East. But it was too late. Dungee's new housing case was already in the system, and it climbed the legal ladder all the way to the Oklahoma Supreme Court, where Dungee himself testified on the stand for more than 5 hours. The court ruled in his favor. Housing segregation was now, once again, illegal in Oklahoma City. Black developments began to spread farther up the east side. Based on such victories, Dungee became nationally known as a civil rights fighter. But he was realistic about the depths of Oklahoma's problems. He had a theory, for instance, about the Tulsa race riots. It sounded like a conspiracy theory, but it also made perfect sense. The riots weren't simply the result of a racist mob, Dungee argued. It was deeper than that, more chillingly rational. The destruction of Greenwood had solved a long-standing problem for Tulsa's white city planners. After all the recent oil booms, downtown Tulsa wanted desperately to expand. But that expansion was blocked by Greenwood. The neighborhood could not have been easily cleared, as a slum might have been, in the name of civic improvement. Greenwood was affluent and solid. These were not tenants, but homeowners. It was the American dream. The riots might have started with primal racial hatred, Dungee believed, but they soon turned into something else, an opportunistic, strategic, city-sanctioned campaign to clear the land. When Tulsa's black neighborhood was rebuilt, sure enough, it was farther from the city center. The white downtown was finally able to expand. Eventually, Ralph Ellison reached the same conclusion his mother once had. A future in Oklahoma City, for someone like him, did not exist. In the summer of 1933, at age 19, after graduating from high school, Ralph Ellison left. He snuck into one of OKC's many rail yards and hopped a Rock Island train. There was no direct route to where he was going, so he rode north, east, and south, through St. Louis and Alabama. He got beat up viciously by white railroad guards. Eventually, he reached the Tuskegee Institute, where he would study music and literature and begin to turn himself into the world's writer. Oklahoma City had already taught Ralph Ellison everything he needed to know about invisibility. Before he could begin to make a name for himself, he was gone. Rainbow. In the absolute emptiness of the middle of the night, Wayne Coyne's Rainbow party crew arrived, one by one, at the point of rendezvous on 13th Street. The headlights of my rental car washed over the neighborhood, revealing block after bleak block of boarded-up houses, pebbled pavement, torn fences, porches leaning hard. Suddenly, out of nowhere, my lights sent up a burst of glitter. This is how I knew I had arrived at Wayne's place. Three jungle gyms sat on the lawn out front, each with a disco ball dangling from its apex. On the front gate hung a canoe that had been painted to look like an enormous smile. Wayne, of course, did not live in a normal house. He lived in a place that everyone referred to simply as the compound. It was its own self-contained world in the middle of the city, a sort of hallucinogenic Vatican. The compound started modestly back in 1992, when Wayne managed to scrape together just enough money to win a government auction of a derelict home in the depressed neighborhood he grew up in. It was a funky building, cobbled together during OKC's building boom of the 1930s out of leftover parts, a spiral staircase from an old movie theater, kitchen tile from a drive-in restaurant, stained glass windows from a church. Wayne fixed it up a little, and the band crashed in it. Over the following decade, as the Flaming Lips rose to national prominence, Wayne expanded his inner-city empire. He bought the house next to the original house, then the house next to that one, and then even more houses. And then he knocked down their fences and bulldozed some buildings and joined everything together into a big, sprawling, psychedelic wonderland that stretched all the way across the block, back to front, from 13th Street to 14th. You could traverse the block without ever leaving the compound. Wayne built a recording studio in the middle, and the yard filled up with mushroom lawn ornaments and various sparkly things and adopted dogs and cats, and, in the center of it all, actual peacocks roaming and flapping. I parked my car near the grinning canoe and stepped out. The euphoria of the uptown house party, the shimmering world in which we had all agreed to this ridiculous scheme, now seemed 3,000 miles away. 13th Street was dead quiet, and its silence felt like a warning. Chain-link fences sagged next to houses that appeared to be abandoned. Wayne produced the cans of house paint and handed each of us a color. I started having flashbacks to suburban vandalisms of middle school slumber parties, egging houses, TPing front yards. But here we were all adults, perpetrators, in a neighborhood that did not look like it was in any mood to play around. Wayne, however, was cheerful and relaxed, totally at ease. At some point, the plan for Operation Street Rainbow had been modified slightly, so now we would be on foot, side by side, dripping paint in a steady stream, Roy G. Biv, leaving a big, bright circuit all the way around the Plaza District. I got purple, the final band of the rainbow. Zach, the Flaming Lips stage manager, punched holes in my can with a long screwdriver. There was some trial and error involved in finding the proper flow. How many holes, how big, in what configuration? But eventually flow was achieved, and so it began to happen. Wayne Coyne's magical street rainbow wiggled its way, slowly, from the front of the compound and into the neighborhood. We walked east along 13th, brightening the pavement, then north of Blackwelder Avenue, a street that shared a name with a man who served on Angelo Scott's Citizens Committee and later invoked the ire of Roscoe Dungee by supporting segregation ordinances, which made it illegal for black residents to live on this very street. We dribbled our rainbow lines up Blackwelder, then took a left at the grilled cheese sandwich restaurant, pouring color past the salon where Nick Collison, the Thunder's backup power forward, got his debonair haircut. We passed the mid-century modern antiques shop and the indie t-shirt store and the tattoo parlor and the local art collective. Our rainbow stripes were thin and wiggly, and they did not exactly cohere. They wandered or stayed true according to the personality of the person doing the pouring. My stripe had no courage in it whatsoever. I am not, by nature, a lawbreaker, have never even received a traffic ticket, and I was terrified the entire time, and that terror was obvious in my line. It looked like purple was trying to secede from the color spectrum. I kept swerving away from the group, walking far ahead, then far behind, pretending absurdly that I was only out for an innocent stroll, that I had no affiliation with these reckless hippie monsters who were sullying the civic landscape of an otherwise fine city. What about the paint can in my hand, the paint on my pants, the paint all over the tips of my shoes? Officer, the world is full of mysteries. I felt like a prairie dog lookout, jerking upright at every little sound or movement. A pit bull barked. A car passed through a distant intersection. I was sure that we were going to be arrested at any moment. I thought about Police Chief Bill City, about Mayor Mick, about all of the representatives of the city of Oklahoma City who had been so kind to me on my visits. I thought about my parents. I thought about Sam Presti. Could vandalism possibly be part of the process? It was hard to say if what we were doing that night was good or bad or neutral, nice or not nice. By my calculations, we were pouring paint onto three different places at once, and the meaning of the rainbow was different in each. One was the city of Oklahoma City, the legal entity, entrusted with maintaining infrastructure, with collecting and allocating tax money, with upholding all of the laws and bylaws and procedures and processes upon which a civilized modern city runs. This was the realm of the city council, of the police, and in this context, we were pretty clearly violating the law. Our rainbow was happy vandalism, funny vandalism. But a legal entity is not designed to register the different moods or effects of vandalism. We were also pouring paint onto a very different place, however, one that I had begun to think of as OKC, the brand name, the PR creation, the city of the Renaissance, of momentum and opportunity, of boosterism, the realm of the Chamber of Commerce. OKC was infinitely larger than the bureaucratic city of Oklahoma City. It was a fantasy that stretched backward and forward through time, from David Payne's Ewing to whatever metropolis the current city builders imagined in their dreams at night. In the context of OKC, our street rainbow was wonderful. Its legal status was the least important thing about it. The rainbow would add raffish charm to the raffishly charming plaza district. It would bring more buzz to a neighborhood that was driving the city forward. It would look good in the morning to the young people of OKC, and just as important, to the potential young people of OKC who were currently living elsewhere, but might see the rainbow on Tumblr or Instagram and file it away among the many reasons that Oklahoma City was suddenly cool. To this OKC, our illegal rainbow was a force for public good. The third entity, and the one I felt the deepest allegiance to, was plain old Oklahoma City itself. This was reality. Everything, the historical place, the kingdom of dimetrodons, history, anthropology, geology, bedrock. This Oklahoma City didn't care about our rainbow at all. We were value neutral, an eyelash in a jet stream. Everyone in town existed in some combination of these three worlds simultaneously. The city of Oklahoma City, OKC, Oklahoma City. Law, fantasy, history. Process, boom, and a synthesis of the two. We were pouring our rainbow onto all three of these places at once, and in each of them, it meant something different. Wayne was pouring the red paint on the opposite end of the rainbow from me, and his line was full of courage. He moved with joy and gusto, expressively, and he actually backtracked, retracing his steps, making sure there were no hiccups in his flow. He would leave no inch of this city's pavement gray. He seemed completely unafraid, happy and free, like he was working on an art project in the privacy of his own home. Wayne didn't even stop when his can stopped dribbling. He actually pried off its lid, then turned the can upside down and walked back over the rainbow for many blocks, covering the whole territory again, shaking out whatever dollops of paint were left. By then, I was back in front of the compound, cowering near my car, bracing myself for the sound of sirens. Wayne returned a good 10 minutes later, happy and relaxed, exuding the spirit of yes. He was a little surprised, he said, that the lines weren't fatter. He'd been imagining a big monster rainbow eating the entire neighborhood, and this was more like a baby rainbow crawling around, babbling out the cutest little colors. Still, it looked cool. Yeah, yeah. Good job, everyone. Wayne was triumphant. My pants and shoes were covered with paint, and I slept for only a few hours that night, fitfully, and I got up early the next morning and drove, cautiously, out to the Plaza District to see if what I was remembering had actually happened. And yes, it had. The evidence was everywhere. An actual rainbow on the pavement, spreading unbroken for many blocks, the whole color spectrum, from the sad trickle of purple to that joyful smear of red. It made me happy. I thought of Angelo Scott picking wildflowers here, back when it was a distant wilderness. The rainbow was a gift from Wayne Coyne to Oklahoma City, a declaration of love, color where it had never been before, color where it had not previously been thought to belong. In that hamburger, the whole essence of democracy lies. August 19, 1958, was a Tuesday, a very normal thing for a day to be. The weather was obnoxiously hot, also normal for August in Oklahoma. But that was where the normalcy stopped. That afternoon, Clara Looper and the children drove downtown. They were dressed nicely, as if for church, in dresses and button-up shirts, everything ironed, and the children carried books under their arms. As they got out of their cars, they probably didn't attract any terribly unusual glances, nothing to ripple the pond of the day. This was on Main Street, right in the bustling heart of everything, near the ornate white skyscraper that looked like a Venetian palace, and the jogs in the streets, and the old juggernaut of the Biltmore Hotel. Clara Looper was 35 years old, in her sundress and cat's eye glasses, purse on her arm. Behind her walked 13 children, all members of the NAACP Youth Council. They passed the parking meters lining the curb, and then under the big neon sign in front of Cat's Drugstore, the creepy humanoid cat, whiskers stiff in the Oklahoma wind, grinning and wearing a bow tie. "Let's eat at Cat's," the sign said, and this was exactly what Looper and the children had come to do, to sit down and order something, like anyone else in the city, to deliberately make themselves a part of that let's. Looper and the children entered the shop. This was allowed. Tuesday carried on. Then they sat down at the lunch counter. This was the moment when a switch flipped, when the previously normal Oklahoma City afternoon turned into something else, a day after which no Tuesday, or any other day, would have precisely the same civic texture. Inside Cat's Drugstore, everyone stopped and stared. The place was busy, as usual, with everyday Oklahomans on break from the office or resting their feet after shopping downtown. The waitress, Looper remembered later, suffered a quick psychological stroke. A manager emerged. Another waitress came over. "What do you want?" she asked, in a tone that suggested she was prepared to give them anything but. The spokesperson for the children was a 15-year-old named Barbara Posey. She put $5 on the counter. 13 Cokes, please," she said. The manager's face went crimson. The children sat and waited. This was a test, a deliberate provocation. Looper and her children were continuing Roscoe Dungy's program of neighborhood expansions, but this time applying that strategy to shared public space. They wanted full participation in the center of the city. They were tired of depending on the small, rare kindnesses of white men like Angelo Scott. For more than a year, the group had written letters and met with city leaders and asked every institution of power to help, but nothing had come of it, and the children, like children, didn't have the patience to wait. They didn't want to orchestrate legal attacks that would take years to unfold, so they would sit here at Cat's until something happened. Before long, the police showed up. Policemen of all sizes, Looper would write in her memoir, with all kinds of facial expressions. Among her many other virtues, Looper was a gifted comic writer. The media followed. Channel 9 with its big TV cameras, ready to document the disturbance. but the police sent the cameras away. This was, in large part, a war of publicity, and the only way to win was to keep it quiet, to let the scandal blow over. No notice of the sit-in would appear in the next day's issue of the Oklahoman. Clara Looper and the children continued to wait. The $5 remained on the counter. White Cat's patrons swarmed to defend the status quo. They told the children to go away, to show respect for law and order. They used racial slurs. One woman walked over, leaned down, and coughed directly into a child's face. Then she moved down the line, slowly, coughing into each of their faces. Looper did her best to remain calm. She encouraged the kids to read their books. She had brought a copy of Martin Luther King Jr.'s Rules for Nonviolent Behavior, and she read it to herself over and over. Somebody knocked one of the little girls off her stool. Clara Looper began to pray. An old white woman approached her with a warning. "If you don't get those little, old, poor, ugly-looking children out of here," she said, "we are going to have a race riot. Don't you know about the Tulsa race riots?" Looper was a high school history teacher with a graduate degree from the University of Oklahoma. She was a lifelong reader of the Black Dispatch and an active member of the NAACP. She could have lectured this woman for 5 hours about the Tulsa race riots. But Looper stayed calm, and the woman left. Looper explained her intentions respectfully to the police, and for several hours the children sat at the lunch counter, keeping their heads down and quietly absorbing the abuse. Finally, Looper and the children got up and walked out and headed back home, away from the city center, back to the east side. We don't tend to think of Oklahoma City the way we think of Tuscaloosa or Montgomery or Greensboro or Selma as a crucial front in the battle for civil rights. And this is largely for very OKC reasons. The PR-conscious local media kept Clara Looper's sit-ins relatively quiet, and the protesters and police managed to work together to avoid any major eruptions of violence. This wasn't the first sit-in movement in the nation. That form of protest had been going on sporadically for decades. But it was one of the first sustained movements that would have such a dramatic effect. OKC's sit-in happened a year and a half, for instance, before the much more famous sit-ins in Greensboro. It was a major domino in the line of civil rights victories that would eventually tip across the entire United States. Looper had benefited directly from the activism of Roscoe Dungee. She studied at the University of Oklahoma immediately after Dungee, with the help of Thurgood Marshall, managed to desegregate it, at a time when metal bars still separated the black students from the white. Looper also watched the way Dungee turned local crises into national victories, the way he and Marshall won case after case in the Supreme Court, the way he eventually rose to take over the whole NAACP. But again, the sit-in was the kids' idea. Earlier that year, Looper had taken them on a trip to New York City, and after experiencing the integrated East Coast, the children could no longer accept segregated OKC, this sort of half-citizenship, where you could enter shops downtown but not try on a hat, where you could order takeout but not sit down. Soda fountains, in Eisenhower-era America, were like the cafes of 1920s Paris, idealized little nodes of the public sphere. They were long, leisurely, wonderful counters where you could sit and order a sandwich, read the newspaper, gossip, belong. The kids wanted that. Looper took them seriously. First, she took them to the people in charge, appealing to their shared Christian values. But the restaurant owners refused to adapt. Looper finally had nowhere else to go, no higher level of appeal. The men working the levers of power to organize OKC, men such as E.K. Gaylord and Stanley Draper, did not see integration as a priority. If the business community, led by the lily-white Chamber of Commerce, would speak, Looper wrote, justice would flow with the speed of an Oklahoma tornado. The Chamber of Commerce's only commitment, as I have seen it, is to the perpetuation of the system. Finally, at Looper's house, over Kool-Aid, one of the kids just spontaneously said it. "Let's go to Cats." So that's what they did. After that first ugly day at Cats, Looper and the kids got up the next morning and did it again. No one had expected a miracle, and there was not one. The second day was more or less the same as the first. The children sat down and ordered Cokes, did not receive them, then tried to read their schoolbooks while white customers hovered around them, hurling abuse. The major difference on day two was that the protesters were not so badly outnumbered. Instead of just Clara Looper and the original 13, the whole community had come out. They filled not only every seat at the soda fountain, but much of the rest of the store. In the evening, they all left together and went back to the east, ready to do it again the next day. Day three, however, turned out to be unnecessary. Cat's drugstore gave in. It announced, officially, that from now on it would serve everyone, black and white, at its lunch counters, not only in Oklahoma City, but in all 38 of its stores, in four different states. Looper and the children, from the unheralded center of OKC, had changed the lives of people hundreds of miles away. They did not stop long to celebrate. Looper and the children began to work their way through the rest of downtown. Every morning, they left the shabby streets of the East Side and marched into the signature institutions of the city center. Responses varied widely. At Veezy's drugstore, just down the street from Katz, the owner greeted the activists at the door, said he had been expecting them, welcomed them inside, and announced that he had already changed his policy. Veezy's was integrated, no sit-in required. But this was the exception. Most restaurants fought. Some chained their doors shut and posted guards outside. Others let Looper and the children in, then poured hot coffee on them. One manager came forward, Looper wrote, grinning like a grinning champion, because he had removed all of his restaurant's tables and chairs so that nobody could sit, black or white. At the Civic Center Grill, behind the courthouse, the owner welcomed the protesters in, then locked the doors behind them, filled the room with smoke, and threatened to douse them with hot grease. Someone had to call the police to come and get them out. This kind of thing went on for months. Some restaurant owners told Looper they were keeping a careful tally of all the money they had lost because of her disturbances, and that they would be demanding reparations from the NAACP. On Christmas Day, a restaurant owner spat directly into Clara Looper's face. Looper, however, was a master of nonviolence. She did not rise to anger. Her rebellion was jubilant. She and the children believed, sincerely, that they were rescuing America from itself. "We love these white people so much that we are going to make them do right," she wrote. "The doctrine of nonviolence is rooted in the fundamental truth that whites are human. We aren't defeating him. We'll be just removing his hostility and insecurities, which will prepare him to function as a whole man in a democratic society." She wrote open letters to America and signed them, "Your Citizen, Clara Looper." She brought a copy of the U.S. Constitution to the segregated Huckins Hotel and dared its proprietors to read it. As she wrote during one sit-in, "Waiting for a hamburger, and in that hamburger, the whole essence of democracy lies." Despite the many hours and days and years Looper spent getting assaulted in Oklahoma's public places, she never hardened into a straight-faced paragon of noble justice. She was not grim. She remained cheerful and silly and weird, one of the great personalities in the history of OKC. Under the stress of death threats, in the face of angry mobs, she broke into song and wrote poems. "If you are superior to me, perform a miracle. Command your hamburgers to sing. Turn your ice cream into diamonds." One by one, the restaurants and department stores gave in to Looper's pressure. Up in swanky Nichols Hills, at the venerable Split Tea restaurant, white teenagers hurled projectiles and yelled, "Go back to Africa!" Looper responded that Oklahoma actually belonged to the Indians anyway, so the white people should have to leave too. Bomb threats and hate mail came to Looper's home, and her phone rang constantly with abuse. One day, someone broke in and burned her furniture. On her porch, the KKK left a sack of shotgun shells. Before it was all over, Looper would be arrested 26 times. The sit-in campaign went on for 6 years. By the end of that time, no segregated restaurants remained. The history teacher and her students had earned themselves, block by grinding block, a space downtown. By then, however, downtown had become a very different place. Universal City. During the second year of Clara Looper's sit-ins, in April 1959, viewers tuning into the evening news looking for the latest footage of downtown arrests or escalating spring weather would have seen, instead, something much more rare, the face of Stanley Draper. It was like meeting the Wizard of Oz. Over the previous 40 years, Draper had revolutionized Oklahoma City, but he was not in any sense a public figure. He worked behind the scenes, cajoling donors on his telephone, brokering secret deals in private rooms downtown. But now here he was on everyone's screens, visible to the public whose lives he had invisibly shaped. The appearance, of course, was strategic. Something important was coming, something that would likely make no sense to most of OKC, and Draper was attempting to rationalize it in advance. It was the civic equivalent of a parent sitting down with a child who was on the brink of puberty, a warning that primal forces were about to be unleashed, explosive growth was on the way, and everyone needed to prepare themselves. The time had come for Oklahoma City to sit down with Stanley Draper for a very serious talk. The TV channel was E.K. Gaylord's, of course, WKY-TV. The news had produced a segment about the city's rapid growth, both recent and to come. Over the previous 20 years, as Draper had secured new businesses and poured new highways out to new suburbs, Oklahoma City had ballooned from roughly 30 square miles to 80, with most of that growth coming in a burst of land annexation over the previous 6 years. This struck critics as excessive. The city government wasn't rich. How could it possibly afford to provide adequate services, fire, police, water, to such a sprawlingly wide area? Weren't there enough problems to address in the city as it already was? How big was big enough? Draper was on TV to help put everyone's minds at rest. He sat on a couch in a wood-paneled office. He was now 69 years old, no longer the young man who had stepped off the train into the chaotic congestion of a pioneer downtown 40 years before. Draper had largely cleaned up that mess. Now his hair was gray, and it stood in a brushy crescent up toward the top of his head, and there were bags under his eyes. As he spoke, a bit of loose skin trembled over the knot of his tie. He was a man from another era, another world, but he still wasn't quite done shaping this one. On the couch, in front of the camera, Draper seemed uncomfortable. A young reporter sat next to him, holding a microphone to his face, and Draper made very little eye contact. A sheaf of papers rested on his knee. This, he told the microphone, was a federal report. And if you looked at page 32, riffle riffle, you would find that Oklahoma City was scheduled to grow to a population of 1 million by 1975. Draper actually used the word scheduled, as if 700,000 new residents were going to debark in an orderly fashion from some kind of cosmic supertrain in precisely 16 years. Draper spoke in the manner of a man who was accustomed to reality obeying his words. After making his majestic projection, he closed the report and paused, looking at the reporter with the satisfaction of a TV lawyer resting his case. The reporter asked Draper about the recent criticisms of the city's rapid growth, worries that it might be spreading itself too thin, complaints from nearby towns that OKC was threatening to take over the whole region. "Oh," Draper drawled, in the syrupy cadence of his Carolina youth, "I wouldn't put it that way." Oklahoma City, Draper explained, was actually doing a favor to the areas it annexed. People in the country were clamoring to join the city, to have access to its services, to be a part of something great. And the city was merely granting their wishes. It was a program of benevolent annexation. Finally, Draper smiled. "There's nothing particularly easy," he said, kneading one knee with a large white hand, "about building a city or community. It brings its difficulties. But I do believe this, that the future, the big growth of the future that's going to come on us so fast and is already on us now. And at that word, now, just for a moment, Draper stared directly into the camera, right out of the TV screen, with a look that cut across distance and time. That future, he said, belongs to those who prepare for it. A projection of 1 million people, it should be stressed, was absolutely absurd, a demographic hallucination. As Draper sat on that couch, OKC's population stood at just a shade over 300,000. He was talking about tripling the city in 16 years, summoning, from nowhere, a Boston's worth of residents. Then again, Stanley Draper had talked crazy plenty of times before, and reality had generally followed his instructions. In his 40 years in power, Draper had already done the impossible. He had guided OKC from a crowded, dusty cow town, plagued by a flooding river, into a sprawling, orderly, high-speed dream of skyscrapers and airports and industries and highways. He had paved huge stretches of prairie, rendering empty land useful to the modern world. He had seen the city boom, then boom again, and he had tried to find ways to harness those booms, to make them surge and echo into one another, to amplify them into super booms. To Draper, 1 million people must not have seemed outlandish at all. As he neared the end of his career, he was thinking bigger and bigger, beyond the future, to the future's future. Why not prepare for 2 million, 3 million, 10 million? Why not? The city would need all the space it could find. Room for the next Stanley Draper, whoever he might turn out to be, the next visionary who would arrive to transform the city again on a scale currently beyond imagining. The biggest threat to OKC's future, Draper believed, was the suburbs. If the settlements ringing the city were allowed to become legitimate cities themselves, to grow and declare independence, OKC would quickly find itself hemmed in. Draper liked to point to Pittsburgh, a great city squeezed into 55 square miles, wrapped in a straitjacket of suburbs. All of those outsiders flooded in every day to enjoy the benefits of the downtown, draining its resources and tearing up its infrastructure, and then they went home to the suburbs, contributing nothing. Draper saw one sure way to circumvent this problem: to claim as much land as possible for Oklahoma City. Land meant control, and land was one resource that Oklahoma still had in abundance. It was all just sitting out there, unclaimed, in the great wide open spaces of the prairie. All you had to do was get there first, before anyone else, and claim it. Once again, Oklahoma City had the chance to make history. Like the settlers of 1889, Draper was not afraid to seize that opportunity, even if it meant doing something completely crazy. And so began the Great Annexation. The same news segment that featured Stanley Draper also showcased the city's brand new mayor, Jim Norick. He was 39 years old, the first mayor ever to be born in Oklahoma City. And unlike Draper, he was made for TV. Handsome and natural, with sculpted hair and a Hollywood smile. Although Norick sounded, in his interview, slightly less sanguine than Draper about the annexation drive, a calculated risk, he called it, he was still officially on board. "Maybe we're biting off a little more than we can chew at the moment," he said, "but give us some time, and I'm sure it'll work out the problems." But time was about to grab space by the ankles and start doing gyroscopic cartwheels all over the Great Plains. There was no longer any time to be given. The Oklahoman published a handy map showing the surrounding areas that Oklahoma City was preparing to absorb. It looked like an impending military campaign, 8 shaded zones on the outskirts of the city, marked for immediate invasion. At the beginning of May, the Great Annexation began. Oklahoma City officially claimed all of the land on that map, and then it claimed some more. In less than a week, the city grew from 80 square miles to 116. During the following week, it continued to nibble at the territory around it until it reached 128 square miles. A week after that, it was up to 160. The city was inhaling everything in its orbit. Clusters of houses that had been previously unincorporated by any town, as well as vast swaths of open country. Distant farmers who had never heard a word from the city of Oklahoma City were suddenly official residents. In 3 weeks, the city had doubled in size, leaping up the national square mileage ranks past more populous cities such as Cleveland, Milwaukee, Memphis, Detroit, and Seattle. Philadelphia, which had 6 times the population of OKC, now occupied only 4/5 of the land. No city had any reason to multiply like this. It was as if Stanley Draper had found a way to reimagine the land run on an exponentially larger municipal scale. In June, the city's radical growth paused. It was like a snake that had just swallowed a goat. It needed time to digest. People were shocked. "I think this annexation business has gotten completely out of control," said the city councilman from Ward 4. A political bloc was organized to try to restore sanity. Even Mayor Norick, the eager young proponent of growth, agreed that things had gone too far. Growth like this was surely not sustainable. But Stanley Draper was not done. Not even close. The problem was that he could see the future, and these people could not. A long article appeared in The Oklahoman defending the Great Annexation. It was curiously unsigned, but it contained all of Draper's favorite talking points, as well as direct quotes from him. "We are going to need industrial sites, lots of them, with integrated housing developments for a city of 1 million, Draper told the anonymous author. "Cities can't plan ahead, except on property inside city limits." Dallas, Draper pointed out, was now more than 300 square miles, and Fort Worth, he claimed, falsely, would soon be expanding to 432. OKC could not afford to fall behind. "The future belongs to those who prepare for it," he said. The article also quoted an anonymous developer who sounded like a fascist hypnotist. "Everyone needs to understand and accept the belief that what is being done is good." The Great Annexation was good, of course, for developers and paving companies and car dealerships and oil executives and malls, as well as for consumers who wanted to live in brand new cul-de-sacs near highways. But it was unclear that it was actually good for Oklahoma City at large. In the end, however, the critics were powerless. The explosion had begun, and it would not stop until it had found its outer limits. The pause in growth lasted for only 1 month. On July 1, 1959, OKC started annexing again, feasting on land even farther out, growing from 160 square miles to 217. This city was now, absurdly, nearly as big as Chicago. Oklahoma City cleared that hurdle the following month. At 265 square miles, it was now knocking on the door of New York City. Meanwhile, back in the increasingly distant city center, 200 unhappy citizens from recently annexed areas, the newest members of the OKC family, packed the city council chamber. An angry debate burned on for an hour and a half. The new residents demanded immediate de-annexation. "Leave us alone," they begged. One said that his community had received treatment worse than anything in Poland. Another compared Oklahoma City to a communist state. "Now I'll sit here and listen to you until your teeth fall out," the councilman for Ward 3 shot back, "but I'm not going to let you call us communists." In City Hall, planners suddenly ran into an unprecedented logistical problem. The official map of the city would no longer fit on any of the building's walls. Before the Great Annexation, the map had been 6 feet square. 1 inch represented 1,000 feet. Now, 6 months later, it was 15 and a half feet tall. The ceilings in City Hall were only 14 feet. The map was not nearly done growing. The following summer, in August 1960, Oklahoma City metastasized to 392 square miles. The 37th most populous city in the nation was now larger than New York and rapidly expanding Dallas and even insatiable Houston. Oklahoma City now occupied parts of 4 different counties. Towns that had once been distant suburbs, Nichols Hills, Bethany, Mustang, Yukon, found themselves completely surrounded. They maintained their independence, but Oklahoma City literally wrapped all the way around them. On the map, they looked like paramecia that had been swallowed by an amoeba, or like islands floating in the ocean of OKC. Only one city in America at this point occupied more land than Oklahoma City. Los Angeles, the palm tree megalopolis, endpoint of every American dream, population 2.5 million. But OKC was coming for it. In September 1960, the city swelled to 415 square miles. Then it caught its breath and jumped again. In 1961, the city of Oklahoma City spasmed to 476 square miles, becoming not only the largest city in the United States, but, reportedly, the largest in the entire world. If someone wanted to know the biggest city on Earth, the one that took up the most actual space on the face of the planet, the only honest answer, impossible as it might sound, was Oklahoma City. Its population was 324,000. Now what? Every rival had been vanquished. All reasonable goals had been surpassed. Every fantasy of the future could now be accommodated. Great networks of new roads were racing farther out into the countryside. Roads as fast as workers could pour them, with identical houses stamped down in clusters to absorb all the residents who were no doubt on the way. Still, the great annexation continued. The project had taken on its own unstoppable momentum. Rival cities tried lawsuits, but they were only pistols at Godzilla. A state senator tried to pass a law to rein Oklahoma City in, and when it failed, he warned Tulsa. Now they are 3 miles out on the turnpike and are coming this way. By the end of 1962, Oklahoma City stretched over 608 square miles. It encroached upon five separate counties. It was nearly 40 miles wide and 30 miles tall. The Oklahoman announced the final surge with a triumphant map. City takes new areas, 71 square miles added. What had begun in 1889 as a modest rectangle, a postage stamp on the prairie, was now an outrageously sprawling blob with tendrils of settlement extending east and west from that tiny original core. Oklahoma City looked, on the map, like the silhouette of an extremely fat man running at a full sprint, arms pumping, legs so fully stretched that he was practically doing the splits. To mark the end of the Great Annexation, another article appeared on the Oklahoman's editorial page. "The annexation program is not a freakish phenomenon," it insisted, somewhat defensively, and then it quoted urban visionaries predicting that this kind of growth would be the future of human settlements. Every city would evolve toward a universal city, a super metropolis that would expand consciously and generously to absorb all the towns around it, functioning more like a county than a traditional city. But why stop there? Why couldn't the universal city continue to grow, the author suggested, swallowing larger and larger cities until it eventually performed the function of a whole state? And why couldn't it grow even farther, absorbing state after state until the universal city filled the role of a nation? The author cited a nuclear scientist who envisioned the United States 50 years in the future as one gigantic city of a billion population. Once you started thinking along those lines, it was hard to stop. Why couldn't a nation-sized city grow to swallow a continent? And why couldn't it cross the oceans and swallow the entire world? And why couldn't that universal city be Oklahoma City? Why couldn't it expand to reclaim all of Pangaea? Why not? Draper's vision, at least for the moment, was slightly more modest. He imagined OKC spreading north to merge with Tulsa, forming what he called a regionopolis, a mega-settlement that would be served by a supersonic airport spread over 100 square miles. It was only 2 years later that Draper managed to secure the privilege of hosting Operation Bongo, the series of experimental sonic booms that would rumble down on the people of OKC for 6 months. Operation Bongo, the chamber believed, would earn Oklahoma City its supersonic airport, And that airport would enable what would inevitably come next. The Universal City, infinite boomtown, exploding again and again until it was bigger than any force that might ever possibly try to slow it down. Pretty much centralizing everything. One afternoon, under uninspiring skies, Daniel Orton gave me a driving tour of Oklahoma City. We drifted for what seemed like forever along a crowded traffic artery called Northwest Expressway, a six-lane corridor that felt like a vast outdoor museum of America's big box stores and chain hotels and fast food restaurants. The median landscaping was sponsored by Chesapeake Energy. Orton grew up on and around this road, and he knew it in amazing detail. As we drove, he read it like a fisherman reading a river. The McDonald's had been there since before he was born, he said, but the Burger King hadn't come until he was six. The Chuck E. Cheese's had recently been renovated. The empty shell of a Walmart had been taken over by an internet-based Christianity franchise called LifeChurch.tv. Orton used to spend so much time driving on this road, exhausted after basketball practices, that he would fall asleep at red lights and wake up to angry honking. If Orton didn't identify all that closely with Oklahoma City, it must be said, in his defense, that there wasn't all that much of an Oklahoma City for him to identify with. It's easy now, as an outsider, to show up downtown and fall in love. The restaurants, the coffee shops, the river. The Thunder has turned OKC into a powerful brand, and there is just barely enough of a city to justify it. But Orton grew up without any of that. There was no coherent downtown, no artsy t-shirt shops or food trucks. It was all sprawl. Oklahoma City didn't even occur to Orton as a place to be excited about, because it hardly even really occurred to him as a place. The neighborhoods he grew up in were mainly zones of traffic interrupted by malls. Orton was born, in other words, into the territory of the Great Annexation, the bloated universe that Stanley Draper left behind. Orton drove me to the house where he grew up, in a quiet subdivision out near Lake Hefner. This was where he had slept off his massive adolescent growth spurt. He'd walked into middle school 5'11" and walked out 6'8", and where he'd blossomed into a high school superstar, and also where he had rehabbed from his first major knee injury while his mother was sick with lupus. Back on Northwest Expressway, Orton drove me past the cemetery where his mother was buried, and he started to tell me about her cooking, the way she'd fill the house with food on the holidays. I asked him if she had any signature dishes. He made a sound like a punctured parade balloon, pshhh, and started listing them. Fried chicken, greens and ham hocks, three different recipes for macaroni and cheese, raspberry cream cheese sauce to be eaten on Ritz crackers. He told me the whole recipe for cornflake potatoes. Every Christmas morning, Orton said, his mother made monkey bread, a doughy pile of cake that's like the middle of a cinnamon roll extracted and multiplied into infinity. Christmas was her favorite holiday, so it was his, too. Monkey bread, his Uncle Jack playing with all the kids' toys. I asked him what he did for Christmas now. Nothing, he said. Christmas games. I work on holidays. We even play on Thanksgiving. Everywhere we drove, Orton and I could see the Devon Tower, the disproportionately huge skyscraper that dominated the horizon. It's really awkward, he said. It looks too tall, standing there by itself. They'd have to build at least one more that big before it would start to look normal. We drove past the building where Orton currently lived, the Founders Tower, 20 stories of glass and concrete that looked like a giant pagoda, an odd relic of the era of the Great Annexation. It was equidistant, Orton said, to all the key landmarks of his life. A 15-minute drive from his childhood home, his family's church, the zoo, the Thunder's practice facility, downtown, and his grandparents' house on the east side. I'm pretty much centralizing everything, he said. We drove east to visit his grandparents, who had lived for 50 years in a small house near the state capitol, in a section of town that Roscoe Dungy originally opened up to black settlement. If anything anchored Orton to Oklahoma City, it was his family's deep roots in the city's black history. His grandparents had watched OKC explode in size, and the white neighbors flee to the suburbs, and the house values drop, and the neighborhood evolve into what outsiders called the ghetto. Orton's grandmother studied high school history with Clara Looper herself,